This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
We'd always prided ourselves on being the kind of friends who didn't just talk about yearly get-togethers. We made them happen. Every fall, as the Smokies burst into flames of red, orange, and gold, Mike, Steve, and I would trek into the heart of it all. It wasn't just a trip, it was our pilgrimage. A way to swear loyalty, not just to the mountains, but to the bond we'd formed back in the carefree days of high school. The drive up to Gatlinburg was filled with the kind of easy banter that years of friendship breeds. Jokes, laughter, and plans for the days ahead filled the cab of my old trusty Ford as we wound our way through the changing leaves. The Smokies in the fall were a sight that could make even the most hardened city dweller think about switching to flannel and hiking boots for good. When we pulled up to the trailhead, a crisp November breeze greeted us, carrying that unique mix of earth, decaying leaves, and the promise of colder nights. It was perfect. Everything we needed our escape to be. But as we stretched our legs and breathed in the freedom, a park ranger ambled over, his face carrying a weight that seemed out of place in the midst of such beauty. "You folks headed out into the backcountry?" he asked, eyeing our gear. "Yeah," I said. "Annual tradition. You know how it is." He nodded, but the concern didn't leave his eyes. "Just so you're aware, we've had some unsettling finds recently. Couple of deer carcasses, mutilated, organs missing. Doesn't look like any predator's work." Steve, ever the skeptic and the most grounded among us, rolled his eyes. "Let me guess, careless hunters? This time of year, it's a wonder the deer don't start wearing orange vests." The ranger shook his head, his expression darkening. "These weren't hunters. The wounds, they're precise, like something out of a ritual." He mimicked a scooping gesture, as if hollowing out an imaginary carcass. "It's got some folks spooked." Mike laughed it off with a joke about satanic rituals, and I couldn't help but join in. The tension broke a little, but the ranger's parting advice to stay vigilant stuck with us as we hit the trail. The hike in was as breathtaking as ever. The conversation flowed freely, but there was an undercurrent of unease that hadn't been there before. Every snapped twig or rustle in the underbrush had us casting wary glances, half expecting to see a circle of hooded figures or the gleam of a ritual knife. But as the miles passed under our boots, the ranger's warnings faded, overshadowed by the stunning vistas and the simple joy of being out in the wilderness with friends. By the time we set up camp, the only spirits we were concerned with were the ones we'd brought along in our flasks. As night fell and the fire crackled to life, the world narrowed down to the circle of its glow. The trees, the stars, and the distant howl of a coyote, the only reminders of the vast, wild world just beyond our light. It was there, in that circle of warmth and friendship, that I felt it. This trip wasn't just a tradition, it was a testament. To the enduring power of nature, sure, but more than that, to the unbreakable bond of friendship that not even the strangest warnings could shake. Little did we know, the real test of that bond was yet to come. The second day dawned with a fog so thick it felt like we were walking through a cloud. It clung to the mountainside, obscuring the trail ahead and muting the world into shades of gray. The kind of morning that makes you feel like you're the only people left on Earth. It should have been peaceful, serene even, but it wasn't. Not with the ranger's words echoing in our heads, turning every shadow into a potential threat. We moved through the fog in silence, the usual banter that filled our hikes replaced by a tense quiet. It was Steve who broke it, his voice cutting through the mist with a sharpness that made both Mike and I jump. "Do you hear that?" he asked, stopping in his tracks. We listened. The quiet so profound it felt like the forest was holding its breath, Hear what? Mike finally whispered, the unease palpable in his voice. Exactly, Steve said. Nothing. Where are the birds? The squirrels? He was right. The vibrant cacophony of wildlife sounds that usually accompanied our hikes was absent. The silence wasn't peaceful. It was oppressive, as if something had warned the forest creatures to stay silent, to hide. We pressed on, the fog eventually lifting, but the silence remained, a constant companion that refused to leave our side. It wasn't until we stumbled upon the deer carcass that the silence was broken, replaced by the buzzing of flies. The scene was as grisly as the ranger had described, the deer's innards removed with precision, leaving a hollowed-out shell that seemed more a message than a meal. Steve, ever the hunter, knelt beside it, his curiosity getting the better of him despite the obvious danger. This wasn't done by any animal I know, he muttered, more to himself than to us. His voice was tinged with a fear I'd never heard from him before, a fear that quickly spread to Mike and me. We debated turning back, but the pull of the unknown, of the adventure we'd sought, urged us forward, a decision we'd soon regret. As we hiked, the sensation of being watched grew stronger. It was a prickling on the back of my neck, a feeling of eyes on us from the shadows. Mike swore he saw something move just beyond the reach of our campfire light that night, a tall shadow that vanished when we looked directly at it. We tried to laugh it off, to reclaim the carefree spirit of our trip, but the laughter was forced, hollow. The sense of unease was a tangible thing now, wrapping around us as tightly as the fog had that morning. Sleep was fitful, filled with dreams of eyes in the darkness and whispers in the wind. We woke tired, irritable, and more on edge than ever. The forest no longer felt like a sanctuary. It was a prison, and we were not alone. Looking back, it was clear we were being led deeper into something we didn't understand, something ancient and unforgiving. But in our hubris, we believed we could face whatever it was and come out the other side unscathed. We were wrong. The third day broke with a clarity that seemed at odds with the growing dread that twisted in our guts. The sun shone bright, casting sharp shadows that sliced through the underbrush, making everything seem hyper-real. But the beauty of the Smokies, usually so comforting, now felt like a facade, hiding something much darker just beneath its surface. As we packed up camp, the unspoken tension among us was palpable. We were three friends, bound by years of shared experiences. But now we found ourselves bound by fear as well. Fear of the unknown, fear of what we had seen and what we hadn't yet seen. We hadn't hiked long before we came across the first of the totems. It was crude, fashioned from sticks and twine. Its limbs splayed in an imitation of human form. It hung from a low branch, swaying slightly in the breeze, a silent sentinel watching over the trail. The sight of it sent a shiver down my spine, a primal warning signal that we were trespassing in a world that wasn't ours. Steve paused to examine it, his hunter's instincts kicking in as he searched the ground for tracks, for any sign of who or what might have left it there. Cherokee used to make similar symbols, he said, his voice low, to ward off evil spirits. Mike laughed, a sound that was more nervous than mocking. Well, let's hope it works, he said, but his attempt at humor fell flat in the dense, silent forest. The totems became more frequent as we continued, each one more elaborate than the last. They weren't just markers, they were a message, one we were beginning to understand all too clearly. We were not welcome here. It was the deer head that finally broke our resolve. Nailed to a tree, its sightless eyes seemed to follow us, a grotesque trophy that spoke of violence and ritual. Beneath it, the ground was stained with blood, a dark, dried pool that spoke of a death not quick or merciful. We need to leave, Mike said, the words coming out in a rush. Now! But it wasn't fear that kept us moving forward. It was necessity. The trail had become narrow, the forest closing in around us, making the idea of turning back seem as dangerous as continuing on. That's when we heard it. The scream. It was unlike anything I had ever heard, a sound that seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere, a cry of rage and pain that echoed through the trees. We froze, every instinct screaming for us to run, to hide, to do anything but stand there exposed in the open. And then we saw it. Across a ravine, a figure stood watching us. It was impossibly tall, its limbs elongated, ending in sharp points that gleamed in the sunlight. For a moment, it just watched, and then, with a slow, deliberate movement, it pointed at us, a gesture that felt both a warning and a challenge. There was no decision to be made. We ran. We ran with a terror that was all-consuming, a primal urge to escape that drove us forward without thought for direction or safety. We crashed through the underbrush, branches tearing at our clothes and skin, the sounds of the forest now a cacophony of our own panicked breaths and the pounding of our hearts. The Smokies had always been a place of refuge, a place where we came to escape the pressures of the world. But now, as we fled through its heart, it felt like a trap, a labyrinth designed to lead us deeper into a nightmare from which there was no waking. The ranger station emerged from the trees like a beacon, its windows glowing with a warmth and safety that seemed almost surreal after the horrors we had endured. Our arrival was a chaotic blur, the three of us bursting through the door, gasping for air, our bodies a map of cuts, bruises, and exhaustion. The rangers were quick to react, their professionalism kicking in despite the wild, almost incoherent story we spilled out. They listened with a skepticism that I couldn't blame them for. Our tale sounded like the plot of a bad horror movie, not something that could happen in the well-trodden trails of the Smokies. Steve was the most animated among us, insisting with a fervor that bordered on hysteria about the creature we had seen, about the totems and the scream that still echoed in my ears. "Spearfinger," he kept saying, grabbing at the ranger's sleeves, trying to make them understand the gravity of what we had witnessed. The rangers did their due diligence, checking us for injuries, suggesting explanations that ranged from dehydration to an overactive imagination fueled by too many campfire stories. They organized a search of the area we described, but it turned up nothing. No totems, no signs of ritualistic killings, no trace of the nightmare that had chased us from the woods. In the harsh fluorescent light of the ranger station, our story did seem fantastical. I could see the doubt in their eyes, could almost hear their thoughts, that we had let our imaginations get the best of us, that the isolation and the wild had conjured up fears from shadows and sounds. We spent the night in a nearby motel, a stark contrast to the rough camping we had endured. The beds were soft, the showers hot, but sleep was elusive. Every sound was a footstep outside the door, every shadow a lurking figure. The terror of the forest had followed us, clinging to our skin like the smell of smoke from our campfire. The next day, we left the Smokies behind, but the experience stayed with us. Our annual trips continued, but we traded the unpredictable wilderness for the predictable safety of beach resorts. The wild had lost its allure, replaced by a deep, unsettling fear of what lay hidden in its depths. As we drove away, I caught sight of a small wooden figure nailed above the ranger station door. It was new, unnoticed when we had arrived, its spindly limbs arranged in a pattern eerily reminiscent of the totems that had haunted our escape. Steve saw it too. I saw the color drain from his face, saw the way his hands tightened on the steering wheel. It was a silent confirmation of our experience, a nod to the truth of our story that only we could understand. Whatever we had encountered in the woods was real, at least to us. It had marked us, changed us in ways we were still trying to comprehend. The Smokies had always been a place of beauty and escape, a place to forge memories and strengthen bonds. But now, they were a reminder of our fragility, of the thin veil that separates the known from the unknown. We had ventured into the wild seeking adventure, but what we found was a primal fear that would forever color our memories of the mountains we once loved. In the end, the wilderness had revealed its true nature, not as a sanctuary, but as a domain where ancient, unseen forces still held sway. And we, mere visitors in its vast expanse, had been lucky to escape with nothing more than a story that would linger in the shadows of our minds, a whisper in the night that we could never quite silence. I hail from a quaint, forgotten corner of northwest Wisconsin, nestled amidst the tranquil embrace of nature's greenery. In this hamlet, civilization seems but a distant memory, with only a solitary gas station and a weathered bar serving as the pulse of the community. Our population, a mere 112 souls, primarily comprised seasoned elders who had weathered the passing of time with stoic resilience. My own abode lay on the fringes of this sleepy town, a parsonage where my grandmother, my two sisters, and I dwelled. For the uninitiated, a parsonage is a dwelling nestled close to a church, intended for the resident pastor. However, in our case, the church leased the property, and my grandmother bore the responsibility of its upkeep. Despite its ecclesiastical roots, our home exuded a certain warmth and charm. Positioned across the road from the church, its facade offered a picturesque view, albeit with an ominous neighbor, the graveyard, casting shadows on the right flank of our property. The house itself boasted a modest layout, 4 bedrooms, a solitary bathroom, and a spacious 2-car garage, all on a single level save for the subterranean depths of the basement. Surrounding the left and rear perimeters of our dwelling lay a dense thicket of woods, a harmonious blend of towering pines, sturdy oaks, and swaying grasses. During the halcyon days of summer, my sisters and I would frolic amidst this verdant haven, our laughter mingling with the rustle of leaves and the symphony of woodland creatures. Yet, amidst the idyllic backdrop of our rustic abode, lurked a tale that now claws its way back into the recesses of my memory, spurred by a conversation with my aging grandmother. As she recounted tales of yore, one particular narrative resurfaced, a spectral remnant from the shadows of my childhood. I once had a companion amidst the woods, a spectral figure tall and enigmatic, whose presence lingered like a whisper in the wind. It stood shrouded in darkness, never venturing beyond the confines of the forest's embrace. In my recollection, its form rose to towering heights, a looming silhouette that peaked from the boughs of trees, adorned with the macabre visage of a deer skull. Despite its eerie countenance, an inexplicable sense of security enveloped me in its presence, an odd comfort amidst the wilderness. My sisters and I would engage in spirited games of hide-and-seek, our voices mingling with the creature's low, melodic cooing, a sound that resonated through the dense foliage like an ancient incantation. Yet for all its ethereal allure, the specter bore a fetid odor, earning the moniker Stinky from my younger sibling. Its movements, fluid and silent as the dance of shadows, defied the natural laws that governed our world. I recall witnessing it scale the trees with unearthly grace, a shadowy wraith traversing the arboreal realm with eerie finesse. One fateful day, upon returning home from the confines of academia, my sisters and I ventured into the woods, only to stumble upon a crude fort fashioned from sticks and detritus. We assumed it to be the handiwork of our spectral playmate, and gleefully embarked on our own imaginary escapades within its confines. Yet our childish reverie was shattered by the anguished cries of our grandmother, her voice fraught with panic and urgency. With trembling hearts, we hastened indoors, where we were met with the chilling revelation of a prone figure lying amidst the grass, a silent sentinel concealed from our youthful gaze. The air thickened with dread as my grandmother locked the door behind us, her fingers trembling as she reached for the phone, summoning the authorities with quivering urgency. Minutes stretched into eternities as we huddled in fearful silence, the specter of uncertainty looming over us like a shroud. When the local constabulary arrived, their search yielded naught but the whispers of the wind and the rustle of leaves. They departed, leaving us to grapple with the enigmatic intrusion that had shattered the tranquility of our sanctuary. In the aftermath of that harrowing ordeal, my grandmother imposed a moratorium on outdoor play, a somber decree that cast a pall over our carefree existence. Yet as the seasons waned and the specter of fear ebbed, she relented, allowing us to once more roam the verdant expanse of our woodland haven. In the years that followed, the memory of that spectral interloper lingered like a ghostly specter, an enigma veiled in the mists of uncertainty. I pondered the nature of our unearthly companion. Was it a guardian spirit, a harbinger of forgotten lore, or something more sinister lurking amidst the shadows? As time wore on, the memory of our spectral playmate faded into the annals of memory, supplanted by the exigencies of adulthood. Yet, amidst the tranquil embrace of the woods, whispers of an unseen presence lingered, a reminder of the mysteries that dwell beneath the canopy of night. As someone who has spent their entire life in the same small area, I've grown quite familiar with the woods surrounding my home. From my earliest memories, I've wandered these paths, accompanied by my parents' faithful dogs. These woods were my playground, my sanctuary. I thought I knew every inch of them like the back of my hand. But one evening, everything changed. It was a typical evening, albeit a bit later than usual. My energetic 9-month-old dog, always eager for his nightly walk, was bouncing around with excitement. We ventured into the woods around 8 p.m., following our usual route. But as dusk began to settle, I realized we might not make it back before dark. So, I made the decision to take the shorter path through the heart of the woods, a route I knew well, but didn't frequent as often. As we trotted along the familiar yet slightly eerie path, I couldn't shake the feeling that something wasn't right. My dog seemed tense too, his fur bristling, his senses on high alert. Ignoring the unease gnawing at me, I pressed on, eager to get home. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed it. A strange archway made of intertwined branches and vines. At first glance, it seemed innocuous, just another part of the natural scenery. But as I approached, I realized there was something off about it. The darkness within seemed impenetrable, swallowing the faint light of the surrounding woods. Curiosity tugged at me, urging me to investigate. But my dog had other ideas. He planted himself firmly on the ground, refusing to budge. Despite his youth, his sturdy frame held me back, a silent warning not to proceed. It was then that I truly grasped the gravity of the situation. Whatever lay beyond that mysterious archway was not meant for human eyes. With a sense of foreboding, I snapped a few quick photos, feeling the weight of my dog's apprehension. With my heart racing, we hurried back along the path, my dog practically dragging me in his haste to escape. Once safely back at the car, I breathed a sigh of relief, grateful to leave that eerie place behind. The next day, fueled by a mixture of curiosity and apprehension, I returned to the spot where the archway had stood. But to my bewilderment, there was nothing there. I searched high and low, scouring the area for any trace of the mysterious structure, but it was as if it had never existed. Haunted by the memory of that night, I couldn't shake the feeling that I had stumbled upon something otherworldly, something beyond comprehension. And though I had photos as evidence, I hesitated to share them, uncertain of what they might reveal to the world, or worse, what they might attract. Fishing has always been my sanctuary, ever since my grandpa introduced me to it as a child. There's an indescribable tranquility in casting a line into the water, surrounded by the soothing sounds of rustling leaves and chirping birds. So when I found myself blessed with a 3-day weekend last month, I couldn't resist the opportunity for a solo fishing retreat in the serene setting of the Smoky Mountains. I stumbled upon a cozy cabin nestled deep in the woods, available for rent by the riverbank. The photos online showcased its rustic charm. A grand stone fireplace, creaky wooden floors, a queen-sized bed, and a basic kitchen. It was a far cry from my cramped studio apartment, and the promise of freshly restocked firewood sealed the deal. Arriving on a Friday evening, I marveled at how secluded the cabin truly was. After unloading my fishing gear, I took a leisurely stroll around the property. The nearby river burbled gently, hidden from view by the dense foliage. As dusk approached, I hurried down the wooded embankment, eager to test my luck with the fish. With daylight fading fast, I cast my line with fervor, managing to hook 2 beautiful rainbow trout before darkness enveloped the forest. Satisfied with my haul, I returned to the cabin to clean and store the fish. envisioning a delicious grilled dinner over the crackling fire. As I settled into the cozy den, a sense of contentment washed over me. The warmth of the fire, coupled with a chilled beer, lulled me into relaxation until strange noises shattered the tranquility. Guttural grunts and rhythmic snapping emanated from the dark tree line outside, stirring primal fears within me. Brushing it off as the harmless presence of a black bear, I retired to bed with a second beer in hand. Throughout the night, I was plagued by the eerie cries echoing faintly through the glass, each one more unsettling than the last. Despite my attempts to dismiss them as vivid dreams, a lingering unease lingered as dawn broke over the treetops. Determined to shake off the night's terrors, I ventured back to the river, losing myself in the soothing rhythm of the water. Landing three more trout before noon, I returned to the cabin to prepare them for lunch. However, my peaceful respite was short-lived as the piercing shriek pierced the air once more, this time uncomfortably close. Blaming territorial disputes among native creatures for the disturbance, I hastily devoured my meal and sought refuge indoors. As dusk fell and the storm intensified, I found myself constantly peering into the darkness, dreading the sight of a lurking menace among the dripping pines. Though the cries ceased, I couldn't shake the feeling of impending danger, triple-checking locks and windows as the night wore on. Then a deafening crash jolted me from my fitful slumber, signaling the presence of something monstrous outside. With trembling hands, I cautiously peered out the window, only to be met with the sight of two glowing orbs and a grotesque, sinewy figure prowling the perimeter of the cabin. Paralyzed with fear, I retreated indoors, the creature's relentless pacing and scraping against the walls haunting me until dawn. When daylight finally broke, I fled the cabin, leaving behind a trail of destruction in my wake. Haunted by the harrowing encounter, I couldn't shake the feeling of being watched, knowing that the malevolent entity still lurked in the shadows, biding its time until its next victim crossed its path. And as I share my tale, I can't help but wonder if those same eyes still track my every move, waiting for the opportunity to strike once more. The moment I crossed into South Dakota, the landscape took a hold of me, with its sprawling prairies that stretched out like a canvas painted in shades of gold and green. I was 17, and the sense of adventure that summer promised was as palpable as the warm breeze flowing through the open window of my old pickup. I was returning to my roots, to a family that was as much a part of this land as the soil itself. As I pulled into the driveway of the family home, the sight of my brother standing on the porch, a grin splitting his face, reminded me why I'd come. The air was filled with the scent of pine, and something sweet cooking inside. My sister and her husband emerged, their smiles as welcoming as the sun dipping low in the sky, casting long shadows across the yard. "We've been counting the days," my sister said, wrapping me in a hug that felt like coming home. The evening passed in a flurry of laughter and stories, the kind that knit families together. We talked about everything and nothing, reminiscing over past adventures and plotting new ones. It wasn't long before the conversation turned to what we loved most, shooting. It was a passion we shared, a way to connect with the land and each other. "We should head out to the woods tomorrow night," my brother-in-law suggested, his eyes alight with the familiar thrill of the idea. "Make it a real adventure under the stars." I hesitated, thinking about my evening shift at the local diner, but the pull was too strong. "I get off around 1 p.m., I said. "We can head out after that." The plan was set. We would pack the truck with our gear, snacks for the road, and the guns and ammo that were as much a part of our family as our shared DNA. That night, I lay in bed, the excitement making it hard to sleep. The anticipation of being in the woods, under the vast Dakota sky, was something I'd missed more than I realized. The next day at work, I found myself watching the clock, each minute dragging on like hours. Finally, 1 p.m. arrived, and I rushed home. The truck was already loaded, my family waiting with that same spark of anticipation in their eyes. The drive was a journey into the heart of what made South Dakota wild and beautiful. The dirt road, flanked by towering trees and untamed grass, seemed to swallow us whole, leading us deeper into the wilderness. When we emerged into the clearing, it was like stepping into another world, one that was quiet, serene, and untouched. But beneath the surface of that tranquility, a sense of unease began to stir within me, a feeling I couldn't quite place. I brushed it off as just the nerves of being in the woods as the sky darkened, telling myself it was nothing. We were here to enjoy ourselves, to bond over our shared love of shooting. Little did I know, the night had something else in store for us, something that would leave a mark on me forever. The woods at night hold a different kind of silence, the kind that weighs on you, thick and unyielding. As we set up in the clearing, illuminated only by the dim glow of the truck's headlights, I couldn't shake the feeling that we weren't alone. It was irrational, I told myself. We were experienced. We knew these woods. Yet the unease nestled itself deep in my gut, refusing to be ignored. "We're all set," my brother announced, his voice slicing through the quiet. Plastic bottles and gallon jugs, our makeshift targets, stood lined up like sentinels in the darkness. We took our positions, the familiar weight of my rifle a comforting presence in my hands. For a moment, as we focused on the task at hand, the unease receded, pushed to the back of my mind. Then came the smell, sudden and nauseating, a stench of rotten eggs, so overpowering it made my eyes water. "What the hell is that?" my sister's husband muttered, echoing the confusion we all felt. This was no ordinary scent of the woods, nor was it the smell of gunpowder we were all too familiar with. It was something else, something wrong. We paused, scanning the tree line for a source, but saw nothing. Then, almost as if summoned by our collective concern, it appeared. A figure so out of place in the natural order of these woods, it seemed to warp the very air around it. Crouching at the edge of the clearing, it was a specter of hunger, its body so thin, its bones seemed to press against its pallid skin. Even in the weak light, I could see the elongated limbs, the way its dark hair fell around its face like a shroud. Its eyes, though, were the worst, empty, yet filled with an ancient hunger. "We need to leave," I whispered, my voice barely carrying. No one argued. The figure watched us, unmoving, as we hastily packed up. The fear was palpable, a living thing that urged us to move faster. As we scrambled into the truck, I couldn't help but glance back. The figure was gone, as if it had never been there. But the feeling of being watched remained, clawing at my spine with cold fingers. The drive back was silent, each of us lost in our thoughts, processing what we'd seen. It was only once the safety of the house enveloped us that we spoke of it again. "Did we all see the same thing?" my brother finally asked. Our descriptions matched, down to the haunting hollow eyes. Yet how could we have seen it in different places at the same time? Was it real, or had fear conjured it from the shadows? I lay awake that night, the image of the figure etched into my mind. In the days that followed, I scoured the internet for stories of creatures that matched what we'd seen, but found nothing. It was as if the woods had whispered a secret to us, a glimpse into a world that existed alongside ours, unseen but ever-present. That night in the woods changed something in me. I had come to South Dakota seeking adventure, a break from the monotony of everyday life. Instead, I found a mystery, a story of my own that I couldn't explain away, no matter how hard I tried. The woods held secrets, and we had stumbled upon one that would haunt me forever. A reminder that some things are beyond our understanding. The circle of forest lay cloaked in a shroud of mystery, as enigmatic as it was isolating. It wasn't vast by any means, merely a 750-meter diameter of dense, untamed wilderness that seemed to exist in a world apart from the rugged, open spaces I usually found solace in. The trees within that circle were thick, their forms strange, almost alien in their appearance, as if nature had twisted itself into an incomprehensible puzzle. This circle was my charge, my responsibility to monitor, tucked away from the prying eyes of the world, bordered by a ring of grassless rock that served as a natural barrier between the known and the unknown. Sitting in my hut, a modest structure of wood and tar, barely enough to keep out the elements, I cradled a mug of warm tea, the only comfort in this remote outpost. Rain pattered against the roof, a relentless drumming sound that had become a constant companion over the past months. It found its way through a corner of the roof, dripping with a rhythmic persistence into a bucket I'd positioned beneath. My rifle, an ever-present shadow, leaned against my leg, a reminder of the dangers that lurked beyond the safety of these four walls. From where I sat, I could see the forest's heart, a dark, gaping maw in the ground that served as the centerpiece of this circle. It was an abyss, a hole that led down into the depths of the earth, its purpose or endpoint unknown. I had ventured into it once, curiosity getting the better of me, only to be repelled by an overwhelming pain that seized my skull the deeper I went. It was an agony that forced me to retreat, to acknowledge that some mysteries were better left unsolved. Robbie, my colleague for the duration of this assignment, joined me this evening. He took a sip from his mug, a contented smile playing on his lips. "Ah," he sighed, "nothing like a warm mug on a cold day." I could only grunt in agreement, my mind elsewhere, lost in the contemplation of our surroundings and the oddity of our situation. "What do you think might be coming up tonight?" he asked, breaking the silence that had settled between us. "Who could tell? Nothing, hopefully," I replied, the hope sounding hollow even to my own ears. "It's been a while since the last one," he murmured, almost to himself. "We're overdue a visitor." I couldn't help but snort at that. Visitor was our way of adding a touch of dark humor to the creatures that occasionally emerged from the hole, a way to cope with the crushing isolation of our post. I had been here for 3 months, with another 3 to go, each day blending into the next, punctuated only by the unpredictable appearances of these visitors. But tonight, I had Robbie. It was a small comfort, but in the vast silence of the circle, any human connection was a lifeline. The rain intensified, a curtain of water that seemed to separate us further from the world beyond. I took a final sip of my tea, setting the mug down with a thunk. "Right, let's head a little closer, shall we?" I suggested, a decision born out of necessity rather than desire. "Into the rain?" Robbie muttered, reluctance clear in his voice. "You know it, brother," I replied, a camaraderie forged in shared hardship pushing us forward. He sighed, resigned. "Fine. Are we splitting up or sticking together this time?" The question was rhetorical at best. In this place, the bond between us was the only certainty we had. "We'll stick together," I affirmed, clapping him on the shoulder as we prepared to step out into the unknown once again, rifles in hand, united against whatever darkness the circle chose to reveal tonight. The rain hadn't let up, turning the ground beneath our feet into a slippery mire that threatened to suck us down with each step we took towards the abyss at the heart of the forest. The downpour obscured our view, blurring the line between the known and the unknowable, between safety and the lurking dangers of the circle. Robbie and I, rifles ready, pushed through the underbrush, our presence an affront to the solitude of this place. The air was thick with the scent of wet earth and pine, a natural fragrance that was usually comforting, but now seemed to carry an undercurrent of warning. The forest around the circle was alive with the sounds of the storm, the howling wind, and the relentless drumming of rain on leaves drowning out any other noise. It was as if nature itself was conspiring to keep its secrets hidden from our prying eyes. As we approached the clearing, the sense of foreboding grew. The circle, with its gaping maw, seemed to stare back at us, an unblinking eye that had witnessed eons pass by. It was a reminder of our insignificance, of the fleeting nature of human endeavor against the backdrop of the ancient and the eternal. It was Robbie who broke the silence, his voice barely audible over the storm. "I just think you'd be so much happier if you quit this business, man," he said, concern lacing his words. Being isolated for such long periods of time, it's not healthy. 3 months, I replied, my voice a mixture of resignation and defiance. So 6 months total, half a year in such a place as this. I trailed off, the weight of his words settling on me like the heavy rain. Robbie shook his head, about to speak, but I cut him off. Something was stirring from the hole, a shadow against the darkness, moving with an unnatural grace. We crouched lower, instincts honed by months of vigilance taking over, as we watched the creature emerge. It was covered in slime, its body an amalgamation of armor and flesh, with rows of sharp legs that cut into the earth with each movement, its beady eyes fixed on us, unseeing yet all too aware, as it chattered in a language of clicks and hisses that sent shivers down my spine. Without a word, Robbie and I raised our rifles, a silent agreement between us. The creature, a grotesque mockery of life, was quickly dispatched, its death throes a cacophony that briefly rose above the storm before falling silent. Disgusting, Robbie muttered, echoing my own revulsion. The question of where these creatures came from, what unnatural forces birthed them into our world, hung between us, unspoken but palpable. The encounter left us shaken, a reminder of the unpredictable and often grotesque nature of our visitors. But there was little time to dwell on it. The forest was not done with us yet. No sooner had we regained our composure than a figure stumbled into the clearing. A man, seemingly lost, his appearance as out of place in this wilderness as a deer in the city streets. His arrival sparked a mix of relief and suspicion in me. Humans were rare in this isolated circle, and while part of me yearned for the company, another, more cautious part, wondered if he was just another visitor, masquerading in human form. The man claimed to be lost, a hiker who had wandered off the path. But as we questioned him, his answers unraveled, revealing the lie beneath. When he could not name a country, any sense of kinship I felt evaporated. I raised my rifle, the decision made in the span of a heartbeat. His transformation, from man to monster, was swift, a grotesque spectacle that ended with a single shot. The black fluid that spilled from his body was a stark reminder of the corruption that lay at the heart of this circle, a corruption that threatened to consume everything it touched. As we stood there, the rain washing away the last traces of the creature, I couldn't help but wonder about the nature of our duty. Were we protectors, standing guard against the darkness, or were we simply delaying the inevitable, fighting a battle we could not hope to win? The circle of the forest held its secrets tight, and as the night wore on, I knew that our vigil was far from over. The night deepened, wrapping the circle in a darkness so complete it felt almost tangible, like a cloth smothering the last vestiges of daylight. The rain had eased to a persistent drizzle, the droplets merging with the mist that rose from the earth, blurring the lines between earth and sky. It was in this twilight of shadows and whispers that the forest revealed its newest aberration, duplicates of Robbie and myself, stepping from the gloom with an eerie familiarity. Their appearance was a jolt to my senses, a visceral punch that left me reeling. I had faced the monstrous, the grotesque, without flinching, but the sight of my own face, mirrored in the half-light, was a horror of a different sort. These were not the mindless predators or misshapen beasts that had stumbled from the hole before. They were something new, something far more disturbing. The duplicates spoke, their voices a mockery of our own, pleading for understanding, for recognition. They spoke of realities beyond our understanding, of truths that lay buried deep within the abyss that dominated this cursed circle of forest. They claimed to come from a future, looped back upon itself, a concept that strained the limits of my comprehension. Robbie, the real Robbie, remained silent beside me, his rifle trained on his own duplicate. I could see the tension in his posture, the barely suppressed urge to act, to end this surreal encounter before it could unravel further. Yet, we hesitated, caught in the grip of an uncertainty that was as paralyzing as it was unfamiliar. The dilemma that faced us was unlike any I had encountered in my years of service. Was there truth in the words of these duplicates? Or was it merely another layer of deception, a trap designed to exploit our deepest fears and doubts? The forest had taught me to trust in my instincts, to see through the lies and illusions that it conjured. But in this moment, my instincts were silent, drowned out by the torrent of questions that flooded my mind. As the conversation spiraled, touching on themes of duty, isolation, and the human condition, I felt the weight of my responsibilities bear down on me with renewed force. The guardian of the circle, the sentinel standing watch over a gateway to unimaginable horrors, I had accepted the burden of this role without question, driven by a sense of duty that had once seemed unshakable. But now, faced with the pleading eyes of my duplicate, with the echoes of a life I could not remember but felt hauntingly familiar, I found myself questioning the very foundations of that duty. What if, in my zeal to protect, to prevent the horrors of the forest from spilling into the world beyond, I had lost sight of something essential, something fundamentally human? The decision, when it came, was a reflex, a return to the training and protocols that had governed my actions since the day I took up this post. The duplicates, regardless of the truths they might hold, represented a breach, a violation of the rules that kept the chaos at bay. With a resolve that felt brittle in its intensity, I raised my rifle, aiming for the heart of my own mirror image. The shots rang out, echoes bouncing off the trees, as the duplicates fell, one by one. The forest absorbed the sound, muffling the finality of our actions, leaving us once again in silence. Robbie and I stood alone in the clearing, the rain washing away the traces of the encounter, as if the forest itself sought to erase the evidence of our doubts. As the night wore on, the weight of what had transpired settled upon me, a mantle of uncertainty that was as suffocating as the darkness that enveloped us. The guardian's dilemma, the choice between duty and the unknown, had been resolved, but the cost of that resolution, the price of our continued vigil, remained an open question, one that whispered in the shadows, unanswered. Dawn was a concept rather than a reality in the circle of forest, a faint lightening of the sky that did little to dispel the darkness of the night's events. The encounter with the duplicates had shaken me more than I cared to admit, leaving a residue of doubt that clung to me like the morning mist. It was a feeling I couldn't shake, even as Robbie and I resumed our positions, watching the whole with a vigilance born of necessity rather than conviction. The forest seemed to hold its breath, the usual sounds of wildlife conspicuously absent, as if the very earth awaited the next act in this unfolding drama. And it wasn't long before the circle delivered, challenging the very foundations of my reality, with a scenario so bizarre, so utterly beyond the realm of possibility, that I questioned my sanity. Figures emerged from the mist, their features becoming clearer as they approached. An older version of myself, lines of time etched into his face, an aged Robbie, his familiar grin tempered by years, and a woman, her features a blend of the familiar and the unknown, introducing herself as my daughter. Their appearance was a gut punch, a visceral blow that left me reeling, struggling to comprehend the implications of their words. They spoke of a future, of a loop that had brought them back to this moment, this critical juncture in time. The elder version of myself pleaded for understanding, his words a torrent of urgency and desperation. He spoke of the whole as a passage, a gateway that connected not just different places but different times, different realities. The skepticism that had served me so well in the past, that had been my armor against the lies and deceptions of the forest, began to crack. The possibility that these people, these versions of myself, and those I cared for, could be speaking the truth, was a sliver of doubt that wormed its way into my thoughts, unsettling in its persistence. Yet, as the conversation unfolded, as pleas turned to demands and the fabric of my understanding stretched thin, I found myself retreating to the familiar ground of duty and protocol. The risk, the sheer unknowable risk of believing, of allowing these figures to alter the course of events, was too great. The circle, with its history of deception and danger, had taught me that much. With a resolve that felt more like desperation, I acted, silencing the voices that sought to sway me with a finality that brooked no argument. The forest absorbed the sound of the shots, just as it had absorbed so much else, leaving behind a silence that was as profound as it was unsettling. Robbie, or the figure I had known as Robbie, watched me with an expression that mirrored my own turmoil. The revelation that the real Robbie had been dead for years, that the man beside me was yet another deception, was a final twist of the knife, a betrayal that cut deeper than any physical wound. As I stood there, surrounded by the fallen, the duplicity of the forest laid bare, I couldn't help but wonder at the cost of my actions. The guardianship of the circle, a duty I had accepted without question, had demanded everything of me, leaving in its wake a trail of ghosts, both literal and metaphorical. The rain began to ease, the first rays of sunlight piercing the canopy in shafts of light that seemed almost otherworldly in their beauty. It was a beauty that felt unearned, a reminder of the world beyond the circle, a world I had protected at the expense of my own soul. The corpses would disappear, consumed by the forest as if they had never been, but the scars they left behind, the questions that remained unanswered, would not fade so easily. The loop may have unraveled, but the threads of doubt, of what might have been, lingered, a tapestry of choices and consequences that I would carry with me long after my vigil ended. Moving to Sunderland, Vermont wasn't exactly my dream come true, but then again, I never really had a dream about the perfect place to live. My parents were the ones with the dream. They wanted a quiet, peaceful life, away from the hustle and bustle of the city. "It'll be an adventure," they said. "A fresh start," they claimed. I wasn't so sure, but then, I hated Boston anyway, with its noisy streets and crowded sidewalks. So, when my parents announced we were moving to a small wooded town, I shrugged and packed my bags without protest. Our new home was a rustic two-story house with a large backyard that melded seamlessly into the western edge of a dense forest. I remember thinking it looked like something out of a fairy tale, with its wooden facade and stone chimney. The forest behind our house was vast and unexplored, a sharp contrast to the concrete jungle I was used to. I was intrigued by it, but also slightly intimidated. My parents, on the other hand, were immediately enchanted. For the first few years, life in Sunderland was as normal as it could be. I made a few friends, did decently in school, and slowly got used to the slow pace of small-town living. The woods became a background to our daily lives, a picturesque view from our kitchen window, but nothing more. I'd venture close to the edge sometimes, always within viewing range of the house, but never dared to explore its depths, especially not after dark. That was an unspoken rule I had set for myself. Everything changed when I was a junior in high school. That's when my nightmare began. It was a late summer afternoon, the sky a dull gray canvas above us. My friend Chris and I were bored out of our minds, flipping through channels on TV, when he suggested we go outside. "Let's smoke the joint I got off Derek in calculus," he said, a mischievous glint in his eye. I hesitated at first, but the idea of doing something, anything, other than rotting away on the couch seemed appealing. "We don't need to go far," I told him as we made our way to the forest. "I just don't want my parents to catch us." Chris laughed. "You've never explored deeper than this?" he asked, gesturing to the familiar boundary I never crossed. "Not really," I admitted. "No reason to." He shook his head in disbelief. "Then it's time for you to go on an adventure." He stopped walking and dropped his backpack to the ground, rummaging through it before pulling out a can of red spray paint. "We'll mark our path so we don't get lost," he declared. I couldn't help but laugh at his sudden Boy Scout attitude. "Why are you even carrying that around?" "You never know when it might come in handy," he said, grinning. We ventured deeper into the forest, Chris leading the way and marking a ring on the trees we passed. The ground beneath our feet was soft, the air filled with the scent of earth and decay. It was quiet, the kind of quiet you only find far away from civilization. It was peaceful, yet as we walked further in, I couldn't shake off a growing feeling of unease. Suddenly, Chris stopped and called me over excitedly. "Hey, Heather, come take a look at this." I approached him, curious to see what had caught his attention. It was a pit, about 3 to 4 meters in diameter, looking as though someone had scooped out a perfect cylinder of earth. Vines dangled over its edges, but the sides were unnaturally smooth. "How deep do you think it is?" Chris asked, lighting the joint. I shrugged, equally fascinated and apprehensive. "No idea. Let's throw something in." We tossed in rocks and sticks, but there was no sound of them hitting the bottom. Just silence. An eerie, unsettling silence that made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. "This is freaky," Chris said, passing me the joint. I took a hit, trying to calm my nerves as I peered into the pit. The more I stared, the more I felt like something was staring back, something from the depths of the darkness. I shook my head, trying to rid myself of the feeling. "I don't like this hole," I said, my voice slightly shaky. "Let's head back." We made our way back to my house, marking our path as we went. But I couldn't shake off the feeling that we had seen something we weren't supposed to, that we had stirred something that should have been left alone. Little did I know, that was just the beginning. The morning after we found that weird pit in the woods, I couldn't shake off the eerie feeling that had settled in my stomach. School felt like a blur. My thoughts kept drifting back to the pit, its silent challenge, and the absolute darkness that seemed to swallow everything we threw into it. Chris was equally distracted, I could tell. We exchanged glances throughout the day, a silent agreement that we needed to talk. During lunch, Chris pulled me aside. "Did you see it too?" he whispered, his eyes wide. "The nightmares, I mean." I nodded, feeling a cold shiver run down my spine. "Yeah, I saw us, from inside the pit, and then something, I don't know, something was watching us." Chris rubbed his face with his hands, looking more tired than I'd ever seen him. "I googled about pits like that last night. Ever heard of Mel's Hole?" I shook my head, and he told me about this bottomless pit someone claimed to have found, which was apparently so deep that not even a super long fishing line could reach the bottom. The story was probably a hoax, but it made our discovery even more unsettling. The rest of the school day dragged on. I couldn't focus on anything my teacher said. My mind was stuck on the pit, the nightmares, and now, Mel's Hole. When the final bell rang, I practically bolted out of class, eager to escape the suffocating normalcy of school. As I walked home, the forest's edge seemed to loom larger, more menacing than before. The thought of going back there made my heart race. But at the same time, a strange curiosity tugged at me. What was down there? Was it just an ordinary pit, or something more? That night, the nightmares returned, more vivid and terrifying than before. I woke up in a cold sweat, my heart pounding in my chest. The dream had been so real, I could almost believe I had actually been inside the pit, staring up at a distorted version of the night sky. The next day, I found Chris in the library, his face buried in books about paranormal phenomena and unexplained mysteries. "We have to go back," he said without looking up. "We need to figure out what that pit is." I hesitated. "But what if there's something dangerous?" Chris finally looked at me, his expression grim. "What if there already is? Heather, weird things have been happening at my house. Sounds, shadows moving on their own. I think it's connected to the pit." The thought of unseen dangers lurking in the woods, possibly making their way into our homes, sent a shiver down my spine. But Chris was right. Ignoring the pit wasn't going to make it go away. We needed to face whatever was out there. That afternoon, armed with flashlights and a new can of spray paint to mark our path, we ventured back into the forest. The air felt heavier, the silence more oppressive. Every rustle in the underbrush had me jumping, half expecting something to leap out at us. When we reached the pit, it was just as we had left it, dark, foreboding, and utterly inscrutable. Chris suggested we try to measure its depth by dropping a weighted string down, but like everything else we threw into it, the string disappeared into the void without a sound. Frustrated and more than a little frightened, we headed back home. The feeling of being watched followed us every step of the way, a constant reminder that we had stumbled upon something beyond our understanding. That night, the disturbances started at my house too. Footsteps in the hallway, a shadow flickering in the corner of my eye, the sensation of cold fingers brushing against my skin. I lay in bed, too scared to move, too scared to sleep, knowing that whatever was out there, it was getting closer. The days following our second visit to the pit blurred into a haze of fear and confusion. Both Chris and I were grappling with the reality that something had followed us back from the woods, something that lingered in the shadows of our homes, manifesting as unexplainable noises and fleeting shadows. The nightmares intensified, each more vivid and terrifying than the last. It felt as though the pit had opened a door that we couldn't close, unleashing something into our lives that we didn't understand and couldn't control. In a desperate attempt to find a solution, Chris and I pored over internet forums, books, and old legends, searching for anything that might explain the pit or how to deal with what we had encountered. That's when Chris stumbled upon the idea of an offering. "It's a long shot," he admitted one afternoon as we sat in my backyard, far from the tree line that now seemed to watch us with a silent, malevolent gaze. "But maybe if we give it what it wants, it'll leave us alone." The idea of giving anything to that gaping void in the woods was terrifying, but we were out of options. The constant fear and sleepless nights had taken their toll, leaving us both on edge and desperate for any form of relief. So we decided on a plan. We would gather items of personal value, hoping that whatever resided within the pit would accept them as a peace offering. Chris brought an old family watch, something he'd inherited from his grandfather, and I gathered a few pieces of jewelry that had been gifts from my parents over the years. We also included meat, thinking that if the entity was more primal, it might prefer something more basic. The walk back to the pit was the longest of my life. Every snap of a twig underfoot sounded like a gunshot in the oppressive silence of the forest. When we finally reached the pit, it was as if the air around us had grown colder, the darkness deeper. Without speaking, we threw our offerings into the abyss. They disappeared without a sound, swallowed by the void. We stood there for a long time, waiting for something to happen, but the forest remained silent, the pit inscrutable. For a moment, it felt like we might have been successful. The oppressive feeling that had followed us seemed to lift slightly, and for the first time in days, I felt a glimmer of hope. Maybe, just maybe, we had appeased whatever haunted us. That night, however, proved us wrong. The disturbances at my house grew worse, culminating in an incident where I woke to find my bedroom door violently shaking, as if someone or something was trying to break in. Chris experienced similar events, with objects moving on their own and an unshakable feeling of being watched. It was clear that our offering had failed. Whatever resided in the pit, it wanted more. The realization filled me with a dread so profound it was almost paralyzing. We had tried to fix the problem, to make peace with the unknown, but instead, we had angered it. Sitting in my room, listening to the sounds of the night, and wondering what would come for us next, I couldn't help but feel a sense of despair. We were out of our depth, dealing with something beyond our understanding, and the pit, with its insatiable darkness, seemed to be at the heart of it all. What had we unleashed? And more importantly, how could we ever hope to stop it? The desperation in Chris's eyes the day after our failed offering haunted me. We sat in silence, the weight of our situation pressing down on us. It felt like we were standing on the edge of a precipice, staring into an abyss that stared right back, hungry and unforgiving. Chris broke the silence with a suggestion that chilled me to the bone. "What if it wants something living?" he whispered, his voice hoarse. I recoiled at the thought. "No, Chris, we can't," I protested, the idea of sacrificing an innocent creature to that thing in the woods twisting my stomach into knots. But the look of sheer desperation on his face stopped me. He was right. We had tried everything else. This might be our only chance to end the nightmare. So, we set the plan into motion, trapping a rabbit and a raccoon in humane traps. My heart ached as we carried them to the pit, their eyes wide with fear. When we reached the pit, it seemed to loom larger than before, as if it had grown, fed by our fear and desperation. Throwing the animals into the void was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Their cries as they fell echoed in my mind long after they had been swallowed by the darkness. We waited, but nothing happened. No sign of acceptance, no feeling of relief. Just the same oppressive silence and the weight of what we had just done. We walked back home in silence, each lost in our own thoughts and fears. That night was the worst yet. The sounds were louder, closer, as if whatever we had awoken was now right outside my window, just beyond my sight. I lay in bed, paralyzed by fear, until the first light of dawn crept through my curtains. The next morning, I found Chris waiting for me outside my house, a look of resolve on his face. "We have to go back," he said. "It's getting worse." I knew he was right. We had to face this, once and for all. We made our way back to the pit, the forest around us eerily silent, as if holding its breath. But when we arrived, the pit had changed. It was larger, and the ground around it seemed to pulse, as if it were alive. That's when Chris turned on me, his eyes wild. "It's the only way," he said, pushing me towards the pit. I stumbled, terror gripping me as I realized what he meant. He believed the pit wanted a human sacrifice, me. The struggle was brief but frantic. I managed to push him away, but in doing so, Chris lost his balance and fell backward into the pit. The look of betrayal and fear on his face as he fell will haunt me forever. I ran home, my mind a blur of panic and guilt. I told my parents everything, and my dad accompanied me back to the woods, but there was nothing there. No pit, no sign of the struggle, nothing. "Heather, there's nothing here. It was just a dream," my dad said gently. But I knew the truth. Chris was gone, and it was my fault. The police investigation found nothing. Chris and his parents disappeared, and the rumors swirled. But I knew the truth. The pit had taken them, just like it had taken Chris. I haven't gone back to the woods since that day. The fear, the guilt, it's all too much. I lost my best friend to something beyond our understanding, something ancient and malevolent that lurks in the darkness. And I know deep down that it's still out there, waiting.